Well, next up, Ruben Uriarte joins us. He's the co-author, of course, with Nori Torres, and we'll talk with him more about these incredible cases near the Mexican-U.S. border next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about our next guest. Ruben Uriarte graduated from Cal State University, BA degree in psychology and Latin American studies. He's got an MA courses in public administration. He has been a member of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, as a field investigator, state director for Northern California, and he's into this in a big way. And of course, he is the co-writer with Nori Torres on a number of books. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Ruben, I had a great hour discussion with Noe, and now it's your turn.
Yeah, thank you there, George. It's always great to be on your show, as always, and then at the same time being able to share our experiences with you. And it's been a really great experience working with Noe on these projects, and it's an ongoing adventure.
How did you two hook up?
Well, you know, George, I always hear you on your show say there's no such thing as a coincidence.
That's so
it
true.
For a reason. and this is what's really interesting was about 10 years ago, History Channel had contacted me because they wanted to do a documentary about UFO cases in Mexico. And so because I had a number of contacts and have been there over the years, and I recommended some names. Well, then they came back and said, and then they said, we're changing the focus. We're going to be doing a series of episodes that are similar to Roswell-type crashes. So we're going to do one on Mexico's Roswell, and which was referring to the Coyame case there. And so they were looking for another investigator to talk about the case, and then he said, hey, you know what? Why should we do that? Let's have you do it. Talk about the case. So they put together the documentary, and I was a part of it. And Noe Torres was watching the program, and then he had contacted me and asked me, hey, can you share with me more about the Coyame case? And then he said, well, you know what? I'm really interested in this research. I've been working on some various aspects of paranormal and UFO events in Texas. He says, how would you like to collaborate and do a book together? And I looked at and I said right away, yes. And so that changed my life, really. I mean, in terms of working with him and writing these books and of our adventures and that. And then in that was hooking up with the network of friends and investigators from both sides of the border. So it's been a very rewarding experience.
Good for you, and great cases too. You've honed in on Mexican-U.S. border cases, of course, with the Mexico's Roswell story, and I had Noe kind of give us an update on it. But I want to get your version too. It's always good to get a different perspective, and then you've got to tell us about this Los Angeles police officer story, as it relates to that he was telling. But tell us your view of this Mexico's Roswell case.
Well, as Noe was explaining that the UFO had collided with the airplane over that very sparse area of Chihuahua, and then it involved having both a search and rescue team from the Mexican Army go out and supposedly looking for the airplane, and instead they found the disc. And what was really quite unique was that the disc was slightly damaged, and that it was approximately 16 feet in diameter. It was a small disc in comparison to other ones that have been reported. And of course, this disc was hauled away. Well, one thing I forgot to mention was that the Mexican soldiers that were there, they were basically unprotected. George, once they recovered the disc and they put it on their flatbed truck, all this was being observed by U.S. Surveillance satellites as well as reconnaissance aircraft. Then they noticed that the Mexican convoy had stopped, and then they later saw a number of the Mexican soldiers laying down on the ground. And so it was at that moment that the team of the retrieval team from Fort Bliss, they came flying into that area, into the zone. And they were wearing protective suits. So that tells us that there might have been maybe some sort of biological agent, or maybe it could have been radiation or
Radiation
something.
or something, something did
Yeah.
them. Do we know if there were any occupants in this craft?
No, George. And see, this goes back to a report called the Deneb Report. And this was a report that was sent anonymously to some of the earlier researchers. Under Springfield, for example, he had received it, as well as Elaine Douglas. And it was a very detailed report, and it was very much written by a military insider. And how and why they disseminated this to a number of UFO investigators, we don't know. But it wasn't until later, when the History Channel wanted to do a documentary, they followed pretty much the information that was outlined in the Deneb report. And what was interesting is that Noe, being so familiar with the area of Texas, he was saying that geography-wise and all the information that they provided was so much detail that these guys really knew what they were doing and what they were really talking about. So that was one aspect of this. But something else too, George, that ties into the Koyama case was that once we started to do some research, then we started to come across other UFO crashes along the U.S.-Mexican border. As he had mentioned earlier, the Willingham encounter when he was a fighter pilot, that happened around approximately in 1955. There was another UFO crash in Laredo, Texas, in 1948. And then we start finding some other interesting events, other UFO down crashes, along the U.S.-Mexican border. And I began asking myself, well, why so many crashes? And maybe one of the investigators that you had on your show before may have brought this up, but I've been very fortunate, George, to have collected so much research material. There are three researchers that have passed away. And they have donated all their books and their research files to me.
That's priceless.
And I tell you, I mean, I haven't had a chance to go through the boxes. But and now that I'm retired, I'm starting to, and I've just been floored from what I've been reading. I came across this document that it's called the PEA, PIA Research. It was put together by a gentleman back in 1988 of all the UFO crashes that have occurred. And he's focusing in just specifically from 1947 through 1978. And so there's 40 crashes that have occurred from 1947 through 1978.
Worldwide.
Worldwide, yes.
Right.
But however, 24 of those cases are here in the Southwest. So the majority of these 40 cases, 24 geographically, came from the Southwest.
That's remarkably high. I wonder why.
That's from New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, and this is the most interesting. And in that, he has here the approximate retrieval of 131 alien bodies that have been retrieved from these crashes.
That's astronomical, Ruben.
And then it gets even more better. That's why I love history. I love the kind of stuff. From 1950 through 1957, there was approximately 17 crashes. So in that period of time, okay, so there was a total of 40, but 17 of those crashes occurred within that 7-year time period from 1950 to 1957. So I began asking myself, what the heck? Why did we have so many UFO crashes, specifically in that 7-year time period? Well, then of course, you know, we were in the middle of an air war. We had a lot of Air Force and Navy fighter pilots that were flying and were given orders to chase these things and try to shoot them down back in the 50s. But another interesting development, I came across this UFO, this FBI memo, and it stated here that that there's a possibility that a very high-powered radar station interfered with the control mechanisms causing these UFOs to crash. And that was back in 1950. So just perhaps that might have been part of the reason why we were having those that many UFO crashes in that particular time, especially in the Southwest.
Now, I had asked Noe if they ever found the occupant of the little plane that collided in the Mexico's Roswell case, and he said no. What do you think happened to him? I mean, did he disintegrate or what?
Oh, well, yes, I would say that because they in the report, it didn't specifically say, it said in general bodies were retrieved, but it could have been exactly that they were obliterated to the point. Again, the U.S. military team had taken all the bodies and the vehicles from the Mexican retrieval team and basically quarantined. They used high explosives. That might have been the reason why there was another huge explosion in order to quarantine the area, keeping a potential virus from going over into the U.S. That's again, why were they wearing the biohazard suits? And then the other key factor is that in the Deneb report, it mentioned that they took remnants of the craft or to Atlanta, Georgia.
Why there?
Well, it just so happens, that's the question we asked ourselves, why Atlanta, Georgia? Well, it just so happens that that's the headquarters for the Center of Disease Control.
Well, and that's in that, right. So this could have been something.
Yeah. Well, so we thinking that that's it's falling into place that perhaps because the Center of Disease Control has all those specific laboratories or labs, laboratory stage four, I believe that they are where all the where they do the most intensive research as possible, especially like for example the Ebola.
And they're quarantined too when they do a lot of that too.
Yes. So those are the kind of questions that have come up in the research, but as Noe and I have been putting this information together, it still leaves a lot of room for conjecture. At the same time, we're starting to get new information. And this gentleman, for example, the police officer, he was actually a listener on your radio show, and he had called in. I don't know if you remember that, but I was listening.
Oh, yeah.
I was listening to your show. Oh, this was several years ago. I think you had Richard Dolan on, and then this gentleman called, and he started talking about Koyama, and I said, "Oh my God, I gotta."
Yeah. Okay. That was the catalyst for you.
Exactly, and I need to thank you again. I mean, I'm sure there are listeners out there that may have bits and pieces to some of the cases that we've been researching, and so here's an example where you have a listener that has had an experience, and then they call in, and then they connect with us or with the researcher, and then from there we just are provided with some valuable information. So there's a possibility he might be calling in on the third hour.
Ruben, a group of scientists over the last couple of days have been getting together at a conference to discuss how and when we start looking for intelligent extraterrestrial life. And they're arguing with each other because one camp says, don't try to find them, like, you know, with SETI doing what it's doing, because they could be dangerous. You don't want to lead them back here. How come they don't look at cases like this and say, my gosh, there's already been contact. They've already been here. They don't seem to look at this. How come?
Well, a couple of factors. One is the scientists that are involved in this type of field. Many of them are receiving their income from grants.
Okay.
And obviously, they don't want to threaten their livelihood, especially if they are going making or are interested in this field. And you'd be surprised, George. I'm in contact with a number of scientists that are basically in the closet. I mean, they are interested in ufology and in this, but for a number of reasons, they are concerned about their jobs and that. However, they are doing their own research, and then they will share some of that. And so there are these small little think tank groups throughout the country. That I'm assuming that, because I'm basing this on my interaction with some of these groups, that are getting together and going over the material, and then they'll go ahead and make contact with the researcher and share that information. So going back to the scientists, I think that once we get a number of them to cross over, like, for example, we do have a number of scientists from a variety of fields in science and in MUFON. For example.
And it's growing, isn't it?
And it's absolutely growing, and the fact that our international connections are also growing too. And so we're finding that we may have some countries that are just far ahead in the research because of the cooperation, and they're taking this subject very seriously.
One day, Ruben, we might bust through and really get some answers that we've all been looking for. That would be a great day, wouldn't it?
Oh, that would. And I think it's like this is a detective story. We're putting the pieces together. And then, you know, and as we are sharing this information with the audience there here in Coast to Coast, then at the same time, we're working closely with our colleagues. I'm always looking forward to going to conferences. In fact, I'm going to be at the International UFO Congress next week. And that'll be my first time, but I'm really eager to meet.
Great. Good people there. You're going to enjoy that.
Oh, absolutely. And but at the same time, I know that they have information that I want to share with them. And at the same time, I think that it's going to further both NOAA and my research together in the particular areas that we've been focusing on.
I kind of want you to paint us a picture. Some of this is going to be, of course, speculative on your part, but these retrieved craft, like the case here on the Mexico-U.S. border, kind of describe to us what you think it looks like on the inside. I know I'm asking for a lot, but I'm curious.
God, George, that's a good one, but a very interesting. And I'm needing to go back to going back to some of the descriptions, but I think the one thing that we need to look at is to make perhaps we see things through our human eyes. We see things, we interpret things through us as Earthlings. And when we're dealing with an object or a craft that's totally out of this world, well, we're going to try to make as much comparisons as possible, and maybe there might be some commonalities. Some of these beings, of course, they've been described as being either 3 to 4 feet, wearing protective suits, and in there, the seats and then almost either the control panels are either very technical or very simple. I've heard that before. The one thing that strikes me, and that's pretty common, George, is that when there are these downed UFOs, for some reason they seem to come in threes. It's they're the occupants or the crew members. It's usually up to three. Although there have been some cases in some of these crashes where there have been up to 16, for example. Of aliens that have been retrieved from the craft.
All right, Ruben, hold on for a sec. We're going to hit the break, but we'll come right back. Ruben Uriate with us, the Koyami incident. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Ruben Uriate with us. We're talking about one of his works, of course, the Koyami incident, which is also tied into Mexico's Roswell, the second edition as that. Most of your work deals with the U.S.-Mexican border, Ruben?
At this time, yes. We've done some other cases, historical cases, but this seems that as we are been concentrating in this area, we are getting additional information. That's why we've been staying focused on it. And that question that you asked me earlier, what do I think they look like inside? And I just, that's still maybe someday we'll really find out, but who knows? They may be crafts from different types of beings from various parts of the universe, and each one of those may have their own different type of technology. Some, of course, that we hopefully may understand, and then that's probably why the whole retrieval aspect of down UFOs are so important, because we want to reverse engineer them. I do know too that that some people do speculate, well, maybe those discs were experimental craft from Area 51, or possibly, well, the question is, and this has been going back to 1974, even earlier, why would you have discs flying over in certain remote areas? Especially for what reason? Unless we were doing some sort of reconnaissance, but why would we rely on that type when we at that time our technology was basically more was more mostly spy satellite.
How open, Ruben, is Mexico to UFO reports and releasing them to the public?
Well, this is something that's very interesting, is that there is actually a disclosure movement that's going on right now.
In Mexico?
In Mexico, yes, especially in trying to get the Mexican government to open up their files. And when we were working with Alfonso Salazar and Carlos Guzman, who are two of the leading investigators in Mexico, we're working on a project with them on aviation cases. We were finding out how there are times that the military was very reluctant in acknowledging that their military had, or their pilots had these encounters, but it wasn't until the pilots themselves gave actual testimony. And the other factor is, George, that the United States has a major role in the politics of Mexico over the years. We have a very much a large CIA presence in Mexico for the purpose of monitoring all the activities in Latin America. I mean, that could be positive or that could be negative, but we're finding that whenever there is a unusual event, seems to be that there's always a military advisor from the United States that's there, giving direction or acknowledging or coordination. We also find out that much of the Mexican military depends on the United States, because a lot of the arms and weapon systems are sold from the United States to Mexico. And so there's this reliance over the years. So as far as the disclosure, it's starting to happen because of the amount of attention in Mexico by a lot of the media there, by the local media. And at the same time, it's also being accepted throughout Latin America. So we're seeing, for example, the government of Chile, where their FAA is working very closely with the French CNES, which is our equivalent to NASA, where they're going to be cooperating and evaluating a number of these UFO reports in aspects of aviation safety.
Are the citizens demanding disclosure there?
Not in a sense as like we're having here, where we're having hearings and that, but I would think that at some time that may happen, especially if you have a very well-known case that is definitely in the media. And there are some certain cases that do come out quite a bit, and we have people like Mr. Jaime Maussan. We have other journalists, other people who have their TV and radio shows that are constantly showing much of what's going on, not only here in Mexico, but throughout the United States. And quite frankly, these people are right on top of it. I've been impressed with the amount of knowledge that these people have gained or in sharing in our conversation. So my hats are off to them. And I tell you, we could not do the research if it wasn't for the help that we received, you know, which I would say it's truly an international cooperation between us two. The other thing, Georgia, just to go back to that gentleman, the police officer that saw that this being, and hopefully, you know, we'll get him back. Hopefully he'll be able to call in. He told us that this being he said that it had red eyes and that it had its forehead had a crest, and that he saw this being staring at him when he was about 10 years old. He was at his
He remembers ranch. That.
Pardon me?
He remembers that. Huh?
Oh, he remember. Yeah, he's sharp. You know, that, well, he's a police officer now in one of the largest cities in L.A. I mean, I was in Southern California, and he went in detail what he was doing and when he saw this being, and he said that he all of a sudden it hit him when he saw this being the Regina case in 1996 in Brazil, that it looked almost identical to the being that he saw. And what's really interesting is that several days ago, I received some reports from a very good friend of ours. His name is Gilberto Rivera. He runs a UFO organization out of Chihuahua, and he periodically sends me reports of what's going on in his estate. And what's interesting is that he's given us reports of other witnesses that have seen these types of the beings that this gentleman that had also seen the same type of being. So who knows that what we're dealing with. The other aspect is there's a lot of paranormal activity in that part of the country. He Bertrand mentioned to me of sightings of Mothman-like creatures, even Bigfoot sightings. So it makes sense, George. I mean, it's the same. I mean, it's just the only thing that divides our border is a fence. So why is it that we can't also get the same type of phenomena crossing on both sides of the border, especially the whole when it comes to these cryptoid-type creatures?
How about the residents in those regions, both Mexican and Americans? Do they see things, lots of light sightings, anything like that?
Oh, they do, George. In fact, when Noe and I were in the Coyama area, we had a chance to go out to a lot of these little ranches. There's these little ranches that are spread out. And one thing about the ranches is that they're people that they keep to themselves, because if you're an outsider, obviously they're going to be suspicious of you. And so we have to work through contacts or through people that know other people in that little community, so that way we'll have a chance to open up and talk to them. But once they trust you, they go ahead and share with you. And we had one really cool experience where we had the mayor's wife and the mayor from Coyame telling us about all the different UFO sightings that their local citizens were seeing. They went, for example, the mayor's wife was telling us that she had a restaurant, and that the locals would come in and then start telling her about these incredible stories of these lights coming out of the cave. Or they might see, or the cattlemen. There's a lot of cattle in that area, and so a number of the ranchers out there will see these strange lights hovering over close to their particular area. In fact, I remember one gentleman telling me that there was a disc that landed on his ranch. And one of the things that he noticed that was very strange was that where he has his horses and cattle, I don't know if you're familiar with what's called salt blocks.
They're for horses to lick, sure.
Yeah. Well, he noticed that they were, he just recently had replenished them with large blocks, and that they were almost gone. Yeah. And then we talked to another rancher who was telling us about a UFO sighting. And then again, he started sharing with us the same thing, that he noticed that his salt blocks in that area had disappeared. So I don't know whether there's a connection, but, you know, you look at all these little clues and you try to put it all together as part of a larger puzzle. So, I think a lot, at the more that we have a chance to go out there, and unfortunately, George, we've had to scale back our research because of the whole cartel situation.
That's dangerous. No doubt.
We could not, so that was the other thing. It's not like we can go across the border, and obviously for the last several years, things have gotten very rough, but hopefully things have improved, and now the possibility that we can go again across the border and or again rely a lot of the information from our contacts.
Well, you've done a great job, both you and Noe, and you continue to catalog some incredible cases. What else, Ruben, is out there? Well, I mean, what's your next mission?
One of the missions that we've been involved in is the whole border zone conferences, and we've been very fortunate in working with the city officials, for example, Brad Newton, who you met from the city of Presidio, Donna Lunsford from city of Del Rio, and a couple others, and it seems that the communities there really do want to maximize not only their tourism, but the fact to educate their community that either a UFO event had happened to them and in their community, and at the same time is just educating these folks to what's going on, not just here locally, but in our entire universe.
Well, you love doing what you're doing, don't you?
Oh, I do, George. And it's like when I have a chance to open these boxes. Now, you know, I gave you some stats. I don't know if these are accurate or not, and I'm sure some of the other our fellow colleagues have looked at it. But again, this just tells me something. When you have 40 out of 24, when you have 24 out of 40 crashes in the Southwest, then says, well, what is it? You know, what is it about the Southwest and Northern Mexico that makes it so unique? Certainly, we have a lot of odd things. The geography itself, we have the Zone of Silence, which is Mexico's Bermuda Triangle. We have the Niaca mines. I believe you may have seen these amazing pictures of these giant crystals that are found deep in the mines. I think that's probably prevalent throughout that entire area, not just in that one mine. Because if the geography is different, who knows what else is buried underneath? And if we have giant crystals, maybe that might be another aspect to it. Of course, we talked about the Marfalites. And the other thing, George, in fact, it was sad we lost Lloyd Pye.
We've lost a lot. Roger Lear. I mean.
Well, yes, and there have been a number of them. And with what makes the star child skull was found in Chihuahua, Mexico, too. That's where So there might be a whole connection on this whole aspect of one of the things that Noe and I are looking at is perhaps doing another book and just concentrating more on the whole aspects of that whole particular region and more in depth.
Ruben, what do you think of these discoveries of what could be very tiny extraterrestrials, these 6 to 8 inch little creatures?
Oh, when you said that, it sent chills. And the reason why I'm saying that is, and that I forgot to mention, I think in the next within this year, we're going to be getting much more information based on discovery of these rocks that have been discovered that have truly depiction of ET presence. And in that, I saw these small little rocks, little beings, very detailed carvings, and I was thinking if there's any correlation to what's been going around the internet. But I'm going to make a prediction, George, that I think the big smoking gun will be definitely coming out of Mexico in the next year or so.
Will that be by whistleblowers or freely?
Oh, both. In fact, there are some things that we cannot say as of yet in our research because, one, we can't verify it, but two, because of the sensitivity of it. I think the big thing we need to be very careful of is that we don't create an international incident based on the information that we're sharing of down UFOs and then you have dead Mexican soldiers and you have a retrieval team, and then that can definitely if we're able to make the connections, it has to be in a way to where it's not going to be looked at in a way where we have people that are totally upset, you know, especially from Mexico against toward the United States and toward an invasion of their territory. It has to be looked at in a whole different light. But I think people will definitely act responsible, and I think that once we obtain more of this information, that we can share it and be able to, you know, look at it more objectively.
I think so too. Ruben's website, of course, is roswellbooks.com, and he's got 6 books out there, all directly related to episodes in Mexico, and somewhat related in each case as well. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and we're going to take your phone calls with him in our final hour. An amazing researcher. If you're into UFOs, he's one of the guys. And, of course, you heard his writing partner, Noe Torres, last hour as well. He is one heck of a researcher. So we're going to come right back. We're going to take your phone calls in our final hour here on Coast to Coast AM.